Thanks for coming on, Father Webster.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Great. Now, you were actually, in the 1980s, you were actually at the seminary up in Rochester for a little while, and Archbishop Tuck actually arrived there. Exactly when? Actually, maybe first you could explain just briefly who was Archbishop Tuck.
Well, Archbishop Tuck obviously was a prince of the church. He was an archbishop of the church. He was the Archbishop of Vietnam, and his brother was the president of Vietnam until he was assassinated in 1965. And Archbishop Tuck went to attend Vatican II in the early 60s. And when his brother was assassinated, Paul VI told him, "You better not go back to your country because you may get assassinated also." And so he ended up not having a country to go to, or not having his own country to go to. And he spoke French. The French had actually evangelized Vietnam, so it was sort of a French Catholic country, even though it was Oriental. But so he felt familiar with the French people and the French language, and he ended up retiring in France and settled down there for a while. He was consecrated an archbishop, I believe, in 1939 under Pius XI. And I believe because of the turmoil in this country, he was actually given permission to consecrate bishops on his own free will by Pius XII without any permission from Rome, which is quite extraordinary. And that permission, by the way, was never rescinded, even to this day.
Sure. That's what I had heard, actually. He was given some actual permission, I guess it was by Pius XII, to go ahead and do consecrations when he deemed it necessary to consecrate people.
Right. Amazing thing in God's providence. For our times.
And probably what, I don't know exactly what the percentage would be, but a fair number of priests and bishops derive their orders from Bishop Tuck.
That's very true, and thanks be to God.
Is it probably like 75% maybe?
Of the traditional bishops?
Of the ones that claim truth.
Oh, I would say at least. Really, they're almost the only line there, except for the Lefebvre line that I recognize or know anything about.
Sure. And so he was there, and actually, what if someone said to you, "Well, I don't think Bishop Tuck was mentally balanced," what things personally did you see that you could say to those people that would refute those kinds of objections?
Well, the first thing I would say to that person is, did you ever meet him? Did you ever talk to him? And the answer is always no. And no one that seems to be spreading that lie, quite frankly, has ever met him or talked to him. Shook his hand or looked him in the eye or anything. So they really don't know. They have no basis to say that other than they heard something from somebody else who had a political reason to be against the archbishop for some reason. But no, he was of sound mind. When I went to the community there, he had already been there, I think, probably for almost a year, maybe 9 months or so. And he was a regular part of the community, participating in the divine office, for example. We used to go to bed at about 9 o'clock and rise at midnight for matins, and he would rise also and participate in matins for an hour or so. And then he had mass about 5 o'clock in the morning every day, and I attended that mass every day. There was no problems with the mass. He also participated in the community meals and was just a part of the community. I don't think he scourged himself like they did at times, but he was basically an active member of the community.
And he actually, I think what happened was when he was there, what sort of led up? He didn't want to go back to his country. You mentioned this earlier. And so he had to find somewhere to go, and so that's how he got in contact with Bishop Louis Vassellis? Or exactly?
Oh, no. What happened is, I don't know if you'll make it go over the history of the first consecrations in 81, but I'll skip that unless you want me to talk about that.
Well, yeah, maybe you could inform some of the people that don't know. He did some major consecrations of, what, two bishops in 1981 in Mexico?
Well, between 81 and 82, there was at least three. There were two Mexican bishops, elderly men. Actually, what happened, let me explain this also. It might be interesting to your listeners.
Yeah.
At the time, Archbishop Tuck was basically in retirement. Archbishop Lefebvre, who was the most prominent traditional bishop in the world. There's really only three that we knew of, Archbishop Lefebvre, Archbishop Tuck, and Bishop Castro de Meyer in South America. Bishop Castro de Meyer would only take care of his own diocese, and Archbishop Tuck was on public record saying he would never, ever consecrate a bishop. Remember, this is about 1981. And Archbishop Tuck was retired, basically, in exile. So two German businessmen went to the Archbishop and they begged him, look, you've got to do something to save the priesthood. This is the situation, as I just described it briefly. And so they persuaded him to consecrate a bishop or two. And so then the next question is, well, who do you consecrate in these times? So he really did, I think, pick the best he could at that time. He picked two very distinguished elderly Mexican priests to consecrate. One of them was head of a large traditional organization called Trento and from Mexico, Bishop Carmona. And then he picked perhaps the greatest theologian in the world alive at that time, which was Bishop de Lauriai, who was a French Dominican, an elderly man who had been at Vatican II also. I think he was a theologian for Cardinal Ottaviani at the council. So anyway, they persuaded him to do this, and he consecrated these three men. And that's basically, as I understand it, the last thing he really did of great significance, other than suffer a lot. But these men then upon consecrated some others, and that is what began the Tuck line. Well, about this time, now it's, I think it's 1983, I think it's the winter of 1983, and Bishop Bezalis had become a Tuck bishop from one step, well, actually from the Mexicans. I think it was Bishop Carmona was one of the three bishops who consecrated him, with the American Bishop Musi from the Tuck line also.
Who was from Texas?
He was from Texas, yeah, Fort Worth, Texas. And he was a good friend of the Mexican bishops before their consecration, and so they consecrated him as the first American. I believe Bishop Musi was the first American Tuck bishop. That was about 1982 or 3. And then, well, what happened is this. The American priest, there was a bunch of American traditional priests who were really suffering, not having a bishop to work with. They didn't know before this happened. Archbishop Lefebvre would not work with them. He only would work with his own organization, the Pius X Society. And so the American priests wanted to have a bishop. You know, they need bishop of confirmation, bishop of holy oils, and things like that. And to, ordain other priests for this country and things. So they had a meeting, actually, in Connecticut about the time Bishop Musi was consecrated. They didn't know he had been consecrated. And they're having a meeting to decide whom amongst them should they select to approach Archbishop Tuck to decide if he would consecrate one of them, you know. And then at the meeting, they discovered about Bishop Musi. So then they ended up going to Bishop Musi. I'm making a long story short here. But to make a long story short, he ended up consecrating Bishop Bezalis from Rochester. He was one of the priests. Well, then after that, they thought it would be nice. I'm not sure how they came about exactly, but the word was it would be nice to have Archbishop Lefebvre come to this country and meet the American priest and the new bishops and take a little break. That was the ostensible reason, I suppose. And at least that's the reason I was given. And so Bishop Bezalis went there to France and escorted the Archbishop back to his priory in Rochester, New York, for a short visit, and he was intending to go back to France, where he was a close friend of this Bishop de Lauriai, who he'd consecrated.
And well, so he goes to Rochester. What year roughly was that?
This was, I believe, the winter of 83.
Okay,
I got that right. Yeah. Now he died December of 84, so I think that's the right time frame. So, anyway, I don't know, but should I continue?
Continue.
So where was I?
You were talking about how he was going to go back to France.
Oh, yeah, Bishop de Lauriai was expecting him to return to France. I verified that directly at some later time and called him, and he said he was expecting the Archbishop to return. Where was he? It had been so long now. It's been almost a year by that time. So anyway, he was in Rochester, and I didn't really know too much about that. I don't think anyone else did either. I ended up going there as a seminarian in the end of 83. As I say, he'd been there probably 9 months or so. And I befriended, of course, the superior, who was Bishop Azalis. We got along, I think, quite well, and I thought he was a pretty good superior in many ways. But then he started to reveal to me some, let us call them dirty tricks or whatever that he was doing, and I was kind of taken aback by them.
What were some of those things?
Well, he told me that the Archbishop did indeed want to go back to France, but he was being prevented from doing so because his passport was taken, actually stolen from him out of his room, so I understood it. And then when the Archbishop applied to the French embassy in New York City for another passport, then that was intercepted when it was mailed to the priory. Bishop Azalis intercepted the mail. And the Archbishop didn't know that, of course, and so he's there, and at that time it was 6 months he had been waiting for this new passport.
So he could get out of there?
Yes, go back home to France.
And so Bishop Vassalis, he actually told you, he actually stated to you that he actually took his passport?
Yeah, he told me that.
He told you that explicitly?
Yeah, this is not secondhand information. Okay. He told me this directly.
Now, what he said that he took Bishop Tuck's passport, and what was his reasoning as to why he said that was permissible for him to do that?
So he couldn't leave. He couldn't leave. That was the reason. Very clear. The reason he told me this, I learned later, was so because he had a lot of dirty tricks up his sleeve, and he wanted me to go along with them. And this was sort of the icebreaker. You know, if I'd go along with this one, then he could probably, he could reveal more things to me and see, I suppose, how much I could take. And
So he told you, just going back to this, he explicitly tells you that he took Bishop Tuck's passport. So he took it out of his room, right?
Okay. Yeah, and that's almost about all I could take. Anyway, go ahead.
Did he also explicitly state that he intercepted it through the mail, or that was just basically assumed?
Yeah, I wouldn't have no way of knowing that otherwise.
Oh, so he also told you that he intercepted the mail passport when he tried to refile and get a new copy?
Yeah, he got the new copy, exactly.
He told me that. And he told you that also?
That's the only way I would know, yeah.
Wow, so he told you that not only did he take the passport from him, he took also the passport that was coming, the replacement one.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, he took them both, right.
That's really something. I think you were saying that actually when you initially arrived there with your vehicle, he basically just told you to park the car in the back and let the fluid out. What was the story behind that?
Well, the car had been in Florida, and it wasn't winterized for Rochester, a much colder place. And when it came, I asked for permission to go down to the street to the gas station to have some antifreeze put in it, and he denied me the permission. Instead, he recommended that I take the car behind the garage and drain all the fluid out of it, and just, you know, like, in other words, don't use it. And he said to me, "You're not going anywhere, are you?" And I said, "Well, no, I wasn't going anywhere, but I didn't want the car to block the brake, to freeze up." So this
way you couldn't even leave, though.
No, and then, so then he had two prisoners. He would have two prisoners, see? I didn't realize at the time everybody was a prisoner there in some way, some form, really.
So in your opinion, obviously, Bishop Tuck was actually, even though he may not have wanted to come out and cause a ruckus there, he was really a prisoner.
He was a prisoner. Yeah. Absolutely, indeed, he was a prisoner.
So what did Bishop Tuck communicate to anyone else when the second passport... when he tried to get that through the mail after his first one was taken, did he communicate to anyone in the monastery that, say, spoke French that he felt like this is really bad and dirty and wants to leave here?
No, he didn't know it was taken.
Okay.
No, they didn't tell him. He thought they hadn't sent it yet.
Okay. What about the first one that was in his room that was taken?
Well, he just thought he lost it.
Yeah. And then maybe thought that they never maybe sent the second one. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
So they fooled him.
So, now Bishop Vassalis, one of the other things I think you were telling me is that, and I actually, someone else told me this, but I thought that Bishop Vassalis was actually not really being serious, that he was speaking facetiously. Someone told me that he hypnotizes people, and I just brushed it off. I had heard this years ago. And that he wasn't serious, that this person heard this from Bishop Vassalis, and not that he actually hypnotizes people, but you actually told me that he not only hypnotized people there, but he tried to get you to be hypnotized.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I understood he hypnotized all of the vocations that were there. And he was, and he did, he tried to sell me on the idea of being hypnotized, appealing to my pride by telling me that you have to be intellectual. So there, if I consider myself intellectual, then I certainly want to prove that and become hypnotized. And also, it's a lot of fun to be hypnotized.
So he explicitly told you that hypnotism can be fun?
Yeah, he said it was fun. It's a lot of fun, and you have to be intellectual, otherwise you can't go under, you know, when you're hypnotized. So, and of course, we want to go under, don't we? You know, it was an appeal to, you know, that was the appeal to do it.
Do you know exactly how he hypnotized people, or just that he did do it?
I don't know. I know he did it. I know one technique, part of the technique, was that it had this strange-looking spiral shape, black and white spiral increasing diameter circles, a spiral type of arrangement. And it was disorienting just to look at it. And he would have you look at that, and then he did something else to you, or said something else to you, and that's how you went under. But I only know that was the beginning phase of it, was the strange thing he had. It was about 2.5 feet square over his desk in his room. And that was what that was for. But that's as far as I got to becoming hypnotized myself.
And so at that point, you were just like, I got to get out of here.
Well, I had one foot out the door at that time, and that was putting the other half of the foot out, half of the other foot out the door. Finally, you want me to continue?
Yeah, you can continue. You were going.
Or I can tell you why that he hypnotized everybody else.
So, but the other seminarians actually also told you that they were hypnotized or were going to be?
A couple of them indicated that, yes. And it's been a long time, over 20 years, but I understood they had all been hypnotized. They'd all gone there as secular vocations. Now, one of them went there with their Franciscan vocation in mind, and then within, less than a year, all but one of them, 10 out of 11, were wearing the Franciscan habit.
So,
they'd been hypnotized before they had made that decision.
But he explicitly said, quote, hypnotism can be fun. That's what you...
Oh, absolutely. He didn't say it can be fun. He said it is fun.
Oh, it is fun. Okay.
Yeah, I never forgot that. Yeah.
Wow. And so, now this led up. Now what happened? Maybe you want to continue the story that leads up to the kidnapping of Bishop Tuck. What happened sort of next?
The Archbishop needed some help. You can only guess what was in his mind. But he didn't want to be there, and he wanted to go back. He was a foreigner and didn't speak the language. He did speak French, and so what does he do to get out of there? He must have thought, well, I have to contact somebody who speaks Vietnamese. He did that. He had a payphone in the hallway, and he contacted someone who spoke Vietnamese, and I overheard the conversation. Didn't understand a word, but I knew he was speaking Vietnamese. Vietnamese to somebody. Well, not too long after that, a Vietnamese priest came to visit him and see him. And we assume he was from the diocese, but we never knew really who he was. And then he visited. They had a conversation in Vietnamese, of course. No one understood what that was about. But I presume now that it was his initial contact with the outside world, and he probably told them his dilemma about not wanting to be there. And so not too long after that, within a week or two, this very wealthy, probably super wealthy, Vietnamese businessman came there with a stretch limousine and a chauffeur and some other assistants in the back. And he owned a couple of hotels, one in New York City and one in Rochester, New York. And he came by. He had called first before he came by. I wasn't privy to that conversation. But apparently he befriended Bishop Azalis a little bit and brought some Vietnamese food for the bishop because he didn't like the food in the priory there, which was horrible by anybody's standards. And he didn't have any, of course, Oriental food there. Anyway, he brought a big case of food, and he talked to the archbishop, and then he talked to Bishop Azalis. And anyway, make a long story short, it was... requested of Archbishop Azalis to let them have custody of Archbishop Tuck for a couple of days, for a weekend, and celebrate a Vietnamese New Year in New York City. and sort of with the promise or the hint that maybe a big donation was coming forward from this, you know, multimillionaire.
And that's what you're saying, that in your opinion, you thought the only reason that Bishop Vassalis allowed him to be sort of taken in the care of these people is that he was hoping for a large donation from this rich Vietnamese businessman?
Yeah, exactly.
And, okay.
And, but the Bishop Vassalis was suspicious and not completely trusting, and so he had one of the Franciscan brothers, Brother Francis, go with him to New York City. He insisted that he be accompanied by him. This is a bishop, this is a brother, I mean, spoke French, and he's a young man, probably early 20s. And the bishop, actually, Bishop Vassalis requested that they, anyway, there's a lot of details, but they ended up taking him to New York City, and where they, Brother Francis and the Archbishop stayed in a hotel near 42nd Street in New York City.
Now, just briefly going back, when they picked him up, I think you said that these guys looked somewhat nervous or were sweating, or someone made that statement, I think.
The millionaire looked very nervous to me.
Really?
He was walking around shaking, his hands were shaking a lot.
Really?
Like they were up to some kind of a crime, you know?
Wow.
And when the Archbishop left, I said to myself, we're never going to see him again. Well, I saw him again, but not, I never saw him in Rochester again. That was the last time he was ever in Rochester.
Hmm. Wow. And so you're saying then they went to New York City?
They went to New York City, and instead of bringing him back after the weekend, he called this millionaire, I think it was Chong or something like that. He called the Bishop Vassalis and asked if he could stay longer, and also asked if he could have some of the bishop's formal attire, you know, his petrol cross and his, you know, dress cassock and things like that. And on the essential reason he wanted to visit some relatives or something. So, again, amazingly, the Bishop Vassalis went along with it and said okay and sent him things. He didn't have a petrol cross there for some reason, but they bought him one in New York City for over $400 and dressed him up. But the reason was not to see relatives. The reason was to see the apostolic delegate, Pio Laghi, in Washington, D.C., but we didn't know that at the time.
And do you think that Bishop Tuck going along with meeting this heretical...
Well, we're not sure if he knew where he was going. They took him off in a limousine. They were always taking him off in a limousine to go somewhere, usually to nice restaurants or something, you know, maybe sightseeing. And so who knows if he knew where he was going that day.
Uh-huh.
I understand Brother Francis did not know where they were going. But whatever reason they gave, they took him off in the car. Now, it's possible the Archbishop knew. I mean, who knows? He might have been trying to use them to get back to France. That was my guess.
Oh, that they would set up something so he could fly back there.
Yeah, and help him get back there or something. And, you know, who knows? They might, all they wanted him to do was to cease and desist, you know, and not be a traditionalist anymore. And they actually wanted him to recant what he had done, to renounce the his bishops that he consecrated, to discredit all of us, you know. But anyway, he ended up driving down to, in his limousine, to Washington, D.C. with Brother Francis. And then there was a, Brother Francis, I believe, thought it was a surprise, because he said that they took him and the Archbishop up to meet Pio Laghi, and lo and behold, the way they engineered it, that somehow they separated the Archbishop and Brother Francis by just a few yards or something, and then they closed the door and locked it in a room, and he couldn't get back in the room.
So this Brother Francis couldn't get back in the room?
No, he couldn't go back in the room where the Archbishop was. And so he called up the priory in Rochester and told us this, you know, where Bishop Vassalis was really upset about that. And he asked Brother Francis to call him back as soon as anything else happens, you know. Well, the details are kind of way far in my memory, but they did end up having dinner together with Brother Francis and the Archbishop, a somewhat amiable dinner. And Brother Francis did indeed call the Bishop Vassalis, and he put Archbishop Tuck on the phone, who spoke to Bishop Vassalis. And Bishop Vassalis asked him what transpired, and Bishop Tuck said that they asked me to recant my consecrations, and that would undo everything I've done, and I'm not going to do that. And when asked again if he signed anything, he said, no, I didn't sign anything, and I won't. Archbishop Tuck said, I just stalled them a little bit. I just stalled them, you know. Well, then the Archbishop...
And this is what, Pio Laghi that's trying to get him to sign something?
Yeah, Pio Laghi, directly. Now, just as a side point here, and I think, remember to the listeners that this is the supposedly this man is gaga senile and doesn't know what he's doing, and yet the apostolic delegate is negotiating with him, and people are taking him places and talking to him, and nobody's even making any notice.
Or he's filing for new passports over the phone.
Yeah, and contacting people. This is a man has his wits about him, let me tell you.
And this is several years after the consecrations he did in Mexico, which Bishop Clarence Kelly tries to say he wasn't mentally balanced. We have to presume his orders are invalid because he was not mentally balanced. He was senile. And and this is in 83 or 84, he's going about and doing all these things.
Yeah, I think the first round here was 81 when he consecrated one of them. And this is, as I say, 84, and so that's 3 years later. And usually if you have dementia, it degenerates and gets worse with time, not better. So
sure.
He would have been in a better condition in 81 if he had any condition in 84.
And I think one of the other things he tried to say is, well, we only have a couple of witnesses to certain consecrations, but as other people have pointed out, there have been many consecrations of bishops with no witnesses that the church has regarded as valid, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely, that's true. Particularly in persecuted countries, like communist countries, there have been secret consecrations done, one-on-one. So, but his consecrations were not in secret. There was a witness or two there, and there.
Yeah.
You know, some priests went to Bishop Castro de Meyer a few years later to ask him if he thought that the Tuck consecrations were valid. This is after Tuck had died. And he was told who Tuck had consecrated, these two Mexicans, and Bishop Delorier. And he says, well, Delorier, if anybody would know it's valid, it's Delorier. He's the greatest theologian there is in the world, and if he says it's valid, it's valid. I would take his opinion over my opinion in this particular matter, or any matter, really. So that was the response, the respect that I should say that Bishop Castro de Meyer had for this Bishop Delorier.
I could be wrong in this, but Bishop Kelly, actually, the Society of Pius V, they won't even give the sacraments to anyone who goes to a priest that derives, has their orders from a Tuck line bishop. Is that correct?
That's correct. As a matter of fact, if you go to a Tuck, the mass of a Tuck priest, they will not give you Holy Communion.
Wow. Wow, that's just amazing. Now, didn't also Brother Francis was mentioning that they actually poisoned maybe possibly the food. Can you tell us some more about that?
Yeah, well, getting back to the dinner that they had in Washington after the meeting with Pio Laghi, Bishop DeZales had told Brother Francis to take a taxi to the airport that very night and come back to Rochester, New York. Didn't matter what the plane ticket cost, just get back as soon as possible. So they went back to the room, the hotel room that they had, and packed up, began to pack their bags, and as they packed up, they were packing their bags, they both collapsed. Brother Francis and Archbishop Tuck collapsed right there. They didn't even get into bed. They were just collapsed right there on the floor wherever they were sitting there working on their luggage and slept like a rock.
So it's not like they laid down in the bed and they fell asleep. They actually were unpacking stuff or packing stuff, and they just absolutely collapsed.
Absolutely collapsed. No, they had no intention of sleeping. They were going to the airport.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
No, they believe they were drugged, and
maybe the food, obviously, yeah.
No, however they did it, you know. I think it's pretty easy to do, actually, if you want to do it.
Wow.
So, anyway, then the next morning, they ended up with the same crowd, and they ended up driving back to New York in the limousine. I'm not sure how that happened, but I think it was described as they sort of needed them for the temporal needs at the time. Brother Francis, you know, was a Franciscan friar with under vows of poverty, and that was that rule was kept pretty well. He didn't have a dime on him. When he had to make a phone call, he had to beg the quarter to make the phone call. So they sort of needed these rich businessmen to feed them and everything, and help them with these little things. And so whatever transpired in the morning, they ended up going back in the limousine with the promise they're going to go to Rochester from there. Okay, go back to this hotel in New York City, then to Rochester. So they did that. They drove, well, they drove back to New York City, but they never came back to Rochester. You want me to continue with the narrative? What happened
sure.
next?
Yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, at some point, then Bishop Bazell was really getting upset, and he talked to the businessman over the phone after they were all back in New York City, and he promised this and that, was going to bring him back. And finally, the Bishop Bazell says, "I've had enough of this," and he said to me, I happened to be standing next to him when he was on the phone at this particular conversation, and he said, "I'm going to New York City right now." I says, "You're kidding. What's going on, you know?" He says, "Well, take a ride with me to the airport, and I'll tell you all about it." So I did. One of the brothers drove us to the airport. I was only going there to hear the story. Of course, we were very friendly, actually. And so we got to the airport, and he says, "Why don't you come with me to the airport?" He says, "You used to live in New York City, didn't you?" I says, "Yes, I did." He says, "Well, you know your way around there. You can help me out." I says, "Okay." So I went there in New York City with him that day without even, with nothing, you know, no change of clothes, no toothbrush, nothing. And anyway, we got there in the afternoon, heading to the airport, LaGuardia, heading towards the hotel in New York City in Times Square. And we got there probably about between 3 and 4 o'clock. We went right to the lobby and walked straight to the elevator. Now, this is an old building, and it didn't have automatic elevators. It had an elevator operator. So as we're walking to the elevator, we had to pass the front desk, and at the front desk was this Vietnamese businessman, very wealthy, and he saw us and ran across the room, very friendly, big smile, shaking hands and everything. Like, "Oh, how nice to see you here, you know." Talk about hypocrisy. But anyway, so he went up to the room with us, up to the suite on the top floor, 24th floor. It was kind of a decrepit suite, but it was a suite. It was actually a welfare hotel where people who were in welfare lived at the with housing paid for by the government, and he had all this money coming in from the federal government to support all these people. So it wasn't that great of a hotel, even though it was a suite. It had a couple of bedrooms and a living room in it. We went there into the room, and Brother Francis was there with the Archbishop, and our plan was to, okay, back up and go. The Archbishop was very sleepy. He had a little touch of diabetes, and they were pumping him with sugar, Brother Francis told me, and any time they could get a drink in him, they put a drink in him, and he was way off balance there, and he was making him very tired, so he was sleeping a lot, and very groggy, you know. They didn't want him, apparently, to have all his wits with him in that regard. So, anyway, they woke him up, and then, out of nowhere, came into the room about at least two, maybe three Vietnamese bishops, elderly men, all over 60 or 70, and, I don't know, three or four Vietnamese priests. It was amazing. They had all somehow come there. I guess they, I don't know where they came from, but they came there to this hotel room. And so they all spoke French, and so Bishop Bazalis spoke to them in French, sort of a cordial conversation, amazingly. And waiting for the bishop to get dressed, Archbishop Tuck to get dressed and everything and ready so we can take him back. Well, when he was finally dressed and stood up and Bishop Zales started to help him to put on his cassock and everything, one of the bishops came in there and pushed Archbishop Tuck right down on the bed. I couldn't believe it.
And wow, so you saw one of the bishops actually push him down on the bed?
Yeah, exactly. Push him right down violently on the bed. I couldn't believe my eyes. You know?
Wow.
And I said to myself, what am I going to do? I can't hit this man. He was only, you know, waist high, and he was an elderly man. He was a cleric. He was a bishop. I couldn't.
Well, I mean, if he were assaulting a bishop, you could you know, restrain him or hit him.
Well, I did restrain him. I grabbed his hands, and I held him. Uh-huh. I pinned him on the bed, which is very easy to do. He was very weak. And I did that as Archbishop Bishop Tuck, I mean, led the Archbishop towards the door. Brother Francis, I'm getting ahead of the story a little bit. Brother Francis had left the room previously to go and call the police because they wouldn't put us, he couldn't use the phone in the hotel room because the switchboard wouldn't connect him to the police station. And at some point, only the bishop was there, this one Vietnamese bishop at this point in time, and one priest was there. And the others had all left for some reason during this time. We were there an hour or so, at least, before this happened. So anyway, we're walking the Archbishop Tuck towards the door of the suite to go to the elevator, and we go through there. This other priest tried to intervene. I had to pin him behind the door, actually. It was kind of... This is a saga for a movie, let me tell you. And so Bishop Azalis and Archbishop Tuck walked out to the hallway and pushed the button for the elevator, and I went out to the hall, and as the elevator opened, it was full of people. It was just amazing how many people were in the elevator, and it was full of several Oriental laymen, a couple of Oriental women, six policemen, Brother Francis. It was a circus. It was like, again, another scene from a movie.
So, but just going back to this, another priest, you had to pin his hand. What was he doing?
Well, he was trying to pull the Archbishop away from the door. So I had to restrain him from doing that.
So it's obvious that they're trying to
hold him there against
imprison this guy. Yeah,
they're holding him there against his will.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And also all the bishops and the other priests were on the elevator too. It was incredible how many people were on this elevator. Well, hallways full of people, and the police wanted to see what was going on. So that's a typical police action. Well, they had to hear the story from everybody, and they had to separate everybody so nobody could hear anybody else's story, you know, and tell a false story or something.
Sure.
So that took a long time because there was a lot of people there, and it's going on, you know, pretty late at night now, 8 or 9 o'clock. Bear in mind, we got there about 3:30 or 4, right? So the police bring us all back into this hotel room, and the big question finally came down to, where does the Archbishop want to be? Does he want to be with the Anglos in Rochester, or with his own kind, the Vietnamese people, somewhere else in New York City there? And so they couldn't ask for one of the group there to interpret for him, for the police. The police didn't speak any French.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to find a translator for the police. Well, as I found out later, the protocol is for the police department, they have professional translators that they use when they want to deal with diplomats. And they didn't use that. And instead, they called a French restaurant and got a waitress, a little girl who spoke French, which is a joke. Never should have done that way. And they had this girl ask the bishop, Archbishop Tuck, over the telephone where he wanted to be that night. Now, who knows what the Archbishop thought. He was exhausted, he was tired, and certainly he didn't want to travel that night, and so he said, I want to be here, you know, and go to bed where I was a few minutes, an hour or two ago, you know. And anyway, so it was confusing, and we're not even sure what the lady asked him on the telephone, but that's where the police took it. And so he ended up staying there that night, and we convinced the police that he had to have Brother Francis there, who was, in a sense, his nurse. And then the other side, the Vietnamese side, put a Vietnamese layman there, who they claimed was his nephew, you know, probably a bunch of baloney, but that's what they said. So anyway, those three are staying in the hotel room all night. We went to stay at, actually, one of my family's, my brother's places, not too far away in Long Island. In the morning, Brother Francis frantically called us. Again, he had to go out and beg the money for the phone call. And from across the street of the hotel, and he'd said that about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, Archbishop Tuck woke up. Actually, he got up before that, I'm sorry, maybe 6 o'clock or something. He got up, he offered mass, and now he wanted to go back to Rochester. Kind of logical, right? Get a good night's sleep, play mass, go back home. And when that was discovered by the other Vietnamese man in the suite there, well, actually, that's when Brother Francis locked out of the room, and he had to go again across the street to make the phone call. Well, when Brother Francis went back to see the Archbishop, they wouldn't let him back in the room. So
now, this is the guy that's claiming to be his nephew?
Yeah, well, of course.
Okay.
Of
course, wasn't, probably.
Probably not.
But he locked him out of the room, and so it was just Bishop Tuck and this guy who's claiming to be Bishop Tuck's nephew.
Well, we don't know who was in the room at that time.
Okay.
Because Brother Francis had to go across the street, and certainly he must have contacted the millionaire businessman who owned the hotel.
Okay.
How many people were in the room then, you know?
But before he went off to make the phone call across the street...
Just the one man, yeah.
There was just this guy who's claiming to be his nephew in the room.
Right, and he locked it, yeah. So he told the people that...
He actually sleeping in the room somewhere in another bed?
He slept... I think he slept on the couch in the suite.
Okay.
Yeah. and then Brother Francis had his room. And
so he's sort of on the same floor in the same room, big room. Okay.
No, it was in the suite. The suite had a living room in it.
Okay.
And two bedrooms.
Okay.
So then we don't know who was in the room, and we never talked to Archbishop Tuck again. Bishop Zales and I went back to the hotel. Obviously, we couldn't get in anywhere. We ended up going with Brother Francis to the police to try to get them to demand to see him again after they'd seen him last night, the night before. Well, by the time we got all this done, it was the evening shift had come on to the police at the police station, and it was the same guys who had been there the night before. I said, what are you guys still trying to get him back? You know, we already settled this case, and they were kind of indignant. Anyway, an awful lot of little details here. I don't think you want to hear them all, but the bottom line was that we decided that we could get an attorney and prove that the Archbishop was in our custody in Rochester by having mail that we had there. Also, Bishop Hills had a power of attorney for his activities in this country signed by the Archbishop. And so it was easy to prove that he had been with us in our possession, and we should be able to see him again and verify that and have him come back with us. That was the plan. Well, somehow, as we were going about getting an attorney and everything, Bishop Azalea changed his mind, and he somehow thought this thing through, and he decided that, here's how he put it to me. He says, you know, this isn't such a bad thing. This is an old man. He's going to get sicker, and we're going to have to take care of him, which tells you that he never planned to let him go back to France. We would have to take care of him. And if they take care of him, we don't have to take care of him. And if they take care of him, then he'll never consecrate a rival to me, since I, as another bishop, he didn't want any more bishops consecrated in the whole world because he wanted to be the only one. So,
wow, so you actually heard him make those kinds of statements.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so this is...
That's just amazingly selfish and evil.
That was unbelievable.
Wow. So he's saying that he's worried that... He says that, we might as well let the Novus Ordo Church have him because he's old, they can take care of him,
they can keep
handle him, and if he's in the Novus Ordo, or at least with them, he's not going to go around and consecrate any more so-called traditional bishops that will be rivals, as you were saying, of him, Bishop Celis.
Exactly.
That's, wow.
So yeah. I was, I almost fell off the chair, and...
Now, so when you mentioned this, as far as like the room that he was in that he was locked out of and he couldn't get back in, he called up and he said he couldn't get back in the room, Brother Francis. Did they eventually try to get back in that room with the police, or at that time they were gone at that point in time, Bishop Tuck?
Well, here's what happened in detail here. We met Brother Francis, I guess it was in the lobby of the... No, we went to the police station when Brother Francis was locked out of the room after the mass, And... we had two police with us, I believe, and Brother Francis, Bishop Zales, myself, and Brother Joseph came down with papers to prove that he'd actually flown a plane that day, Brother Joseph, and come down with papers proving that we had been with Archbishop Tucker, lived with us. And we were all going up to the room together with the police, and as I said, it was a manually operated elevator. The elevator operator would not take us upstairs, even with the police.
Really?
Yeah, and so then we were on the elevator, and one cop was called to the desk to talk on the phone, and he was talking to Mr. Chong upstairs in the suite, and the other one was in the elevator with us, and then after about 10 minutes on the phone, the other officer came back and said, okay, you men get off the elevator, and then he and the other officer went upstairs to talk to the Archbishop. Well, we knew at that point that we were never going to see the Archbishop again, because we knew that the man was too clever upstairs, and they were going to just... I'll fool the police. And sure enough, the police came down and said, well, he wants to be here. That's the end of that.
Wow.
And that's when we decided to
Ask to say, can we talk to Bishop Tuck? Or
well, the plan was to have both sides talk to him again in the daytime when he was alert and wide awake,
Uh-huh.
And Mr. Chong, the millionaire, thwarted that idea. Who knows what he told the police?
Wow. And so
he might have bribed the police. Who knows what he did? He might have given thousands of dollars. Who knows what he did?
And so at that point, you basically had to give up, and that was the last you saw of Bishop Tuck?
Well, the only other recourse was legal recourse with an attorney to try and get him back. And that's when the Bishop Azalea decided not to pursue it anymore. And instead, I found myself in a taxicab with the three Franciscans. I was not in a Franciscan habit. I was in a cassock. But we were all going back to the LaGuardia Airport to go back to Rochester. And Bishop Azalea was explaining to me what I just said, that he wants to... it's better that he stays where he is. We don't have anything to do with him anymore. And... Yeah, my stomach was turning, you know.
Wow. And that was on the flight back or on the...
It was in the taxi cab on the way to the airport.
That's where he made those statements.
Yeah, and then in the airport, I remember the airplane too now, I happened to be sitting right in front of the Bishop Azalea, and he was repeating these things over and over, you know, and we should all go along with this thing. And then the brothers finally realized that, you know, they knew they'd been with the Bishop Azalea for a couple of years. They knew that you have to go along with him. And so they changed their viewpoints. I don't think they agreed with the bishop in the first place, but then after they realized that was a party line and a politically right thing to hold, they went along with him, and they all tried to talk me into going along with it. Well, I didn't want to say too much contrary to them because I was still living there and didn't want to be out in the street that night myself. So I just sort of nodded and bit my tongue. But in my heart, I said, I'm out of here.
Well, I mean, at that point, someone would have to say that, you know, that's wrong, you know, at that point. Because, I mean, that's clearly evil to have someone saying that he should stay in the Novus Ordo Church. And so he doesn't consecrate people. And, you know, I mean, someone would have to say something at that point. I was going to ask you, though, this this power of attorney that he had, was that willingly given to Bishop?
I wonder how that was. That was probably by subterfuge also. He didn't tell me how he got that.
Okay.
But I would think that he probably tricked him into signing something. Who knows? But.
Wow. And so he calls off, you know, basically going any further on this investigation as to what happened at that point because he just figured, you know, let the Novus Ordo have them. And
yeah, and obviously, you know, if it was above board, if he wanted to be with them, then they would have let us, he could have told us right to, the Archbishop Tuck could have told everybody right to our faces and been right out in the open about it. The fact that it happened behind closed doors tells us that that wasn't his will.
Yeah. What about...
So he abandoned him, in other words.
What about as far as any of the... I know the passport, Bishop Azalea told you he took his passport. But how about any other letters or calls that were coming in? Were they also intercepted? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, actually, as I vaguely remember, there were calls from Europe quite frequently, actually, and I don't think he ever got those calls. People wanted to talk to him, and they could never get him on the phone. You know, every phone call that came in would be intercepted, but you couldn't call the Archbishop directly on the community phone.
They just wouldn't give him the phone.
No, they wouldn't give the phone. He didn't have a phone in this room. He was living in a little tiny cell. It was a disgrace that an Archbishop was living in such a quarters. They didn't care.
Now, he, as you know, as far as Bishop Azalea, has this idea that he's the only bishop in the whole world, and he obviously is confused of the difference between supplied jurisdiction and ordinary jurisdiction, which in normal situations, a pope is the only one that can give a mandate for a consecration of a bishop, and if it's not done with that mandate, it's an automatic excommunication. Of course, we're not in that time, but and he obviously was not consecrated himself, Bishop Azalea, with a mandate from a real pope, which we can, you know, a person could understand how a person could go about doing that in an emergency situation such as we're in to give the sacraments.
Right.
But he claims to have ordinary jurisdiction. So I think another priest was telling me that at one point in time, I don't know if it was in the 1980s, he sent out a letter to all the other so-called traditional bishops throughout the country telling them that they all need to report to him, Bishop Azalea, for orders as to what they need to do next. And
did you hear
about that?
Oh, yeah, I sure did. Bishop Musi and him, Bishop Musi didn't claim ordinary jurisdiction, and Azalea sort of talked them into claiming it. And then they divided the country up in half. And then there were only two at the time. So
yeah, Musi had what, the western part of the United States, and Azalea the eastern part.
Yeah, these had a diocese, half the country. Yeah. And then Azalea sent out this letter, as you just correctly stated, to all the priests, not to the bishops.
Okay, the priests. Okay.
And demanded that they report to him in 2 weeks, or they'd be excommunicated. Well, the priests got this letter. What? Who is this? You know, they were mystified, and I don't think any of them complied to it.
So he did. He just sent it to the priests. He didn't send it to the other bishops, also.
Well, there were no other bishops at the time except Musi.
Okay.
That was it.
Hmm. What about Bishop McKenna? Or that was later?
That was several years later.
Okay.
Yeah. No, they're the first ones. First ones, amazing.
And what's ironic is that Pope Pius XII in his encyclical Mystici Corpus Christi of June 29th, 1943, in point 42 of that encyclical, he points out that bishops receive ordinary jurisdiction from a pope.
Well, obviously, if you can justify we can justify the consecration, but you can't claim jurisdiction. Yeah. It has to come from the pope, absolutely.
And so this idea of him being the only bishop throughout the whole world and everyone needs to report to him... I guess that was the mentality between his selfish outlook, incredibly evil and selfish outlook of allowing Bishop Tucker, thinking it might be a good idea or providential maybe even, that Bishop Tuck's in the hands of the Novus Ordo Church, so no more rival, quote, traditional bishops are consecrated.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it selfish so much as ambitious. He was just very ambitious. And I understand he's still away to this day.
He also, I know for a fact, because I know some people that actually were going up to his chapel, may still actually go there, where he actually had certain people sign a document where they actually had to sign their names to a declaration that he was the only Catholic bishop in the whole world, and he was the only lawful, I think maybe the language might be, the only lawful Catholic bishops throughout the whole world, and that everybody to be Catholic has to submit to him and all his lawful successors. We have it somewhere. I don't know the exact wording on the document, but it's actually quite incredible.
Yeah, I've heard that secondhand.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. We have a copy of it somewhere, but it's almost like a papal kind of thing that you have to agree to. It's just really quite amazing. Someone else was saying that he actually holds the position that you can be possessed by demons if you eat unblessed food. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I never heard that one.
Okay, someone was saying, I was just trying to find out about that. Wow, that's... So that's quite a story. Now, some of the other objections, people have said that why did Bishop Tuck consecrate... for example, in Palmer de Troya, Spain, I believe it is.
Uh-huh.
And I know that Brother Joseph, the founder of our community, made a visit one time out there years ago just to see what this was all about. He knew really very, very little of what was going on out there.
In Palmer de Troya.
Yeah, and he just said that their processions, the devotion seemed quite amazing. He said if you could see it from the people. But... obviously, I think what Bishop Tuck went down there, consecrated this guy Clemente, I believe it was, and it was after his consecration of him that he then came out and claimed to be Pope.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, what happened is, amazingly, Archbishop Tuck was in a cone with Archbishop Lefebvre about 1975, thereabouts, and... a group of these men from Palma de Troya, who appeared to be very holy and saintly and everything, came there and said, we're having apparitions of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and she's telling us what to do to save the church and everything, and she wants us to have a bishop consecrated, and can you, comply with her wishes, So they went to Archbishop Lefebvre and told him that, so he went to Archbishop Tuck and said, listen, I don't have the time to go there, I'm running the seminary, why don't you go down there, and so they drove Archbishop Tuck down the Palma de Troya. He really didn't know what he was getting himself into. But at the time, he went there, and he saw a lot of piety and prayers and devotions, and they seemed like very holy people indeed, and they convinced him the Blessed Virgin Mary was there or something like that. And he consecrated that man Clemente. Well, things were, I still think, quite normal at that time, but 3 or 4 months later, I think this happened in March, the following May, Clemente, the man was in an automobile accident, had a very severe head injury such that he went blind, and then he came out not too long after that claiming that heaven or Jesus Christ or someone had declared him to be the Pope. Well, about...
That's what he was claiming, yeah.
Yeah, and this is, probably, I think, September or something like that. And Archbishop Tuck and a few others said, well, I'm out of here, and they left there. They wanted nothing to do with that.
And didn't he actually, he wrote a letter denouncing his activity, I think.
He renounced it. Yeah, he renounced all that activity. Uh-huh. And he only, I think, consecrated one man. I'm not sure of that, but if not, only a couple. And then this Clemente went crazy. He started consecrating everybody under the sun, as I understand it. And it gave a bad name to Archbishop Tuck.
Yeah, he was like making 15-year-olds cardinals.
They were doing everything. Yeah. But Tuck didn't do that. He had no intention to do anything like that. Yeah. He was just trying to do something good, and thinking that came from Our Lady.
I think I did see actually the letter he wrote denouncing Clemente's activity.
That's an unfortunate thing that people use a smear Tuck with. And so after that, he said, "Well, enough of this." And that's when he went back to France and didn't do anything until 1981. You know, he was just said, "I'm not going to get involved with this kind of stuff anymore."
And when he consecrated those two priests from, was it Mexico? Was that in Germany he did that?
No, it was in France.
It was in France, okay.
Yeah, and same with Delorier. It was all in France.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the history on anything else that people should know about the consecrations or the ordinations?
I'll tell you what I always tell people. That historically, that's pretty much it, and very briefly, of course. But the Tuck line is not organized. There's no formal organization of the Tuck bishops and priests, which is unfortunate. But what you can say about them that's very positive is that they're 100% valid. All the ceremonies, all the sacraments are done in the traditional rites with the traditional oils. And they're orthodox.
Not all of them. Not every one of them, because there are quite a few that believe people in other religions can be saved and baptism.
Well, other than that controversial dogma, I shouldn't say controversial, but I mean, well, okay, you have a point.
And also natural family planning. A lot of them believe that it's permissible to, limit the size of the family. So those would be the two issues.
Well, what I meant is they're not like the Greek Orthodox or the old Catholics. You can't put them in that category.
Well, no, I wouldn't put them in the same category as them, yeah. No.
So, but anyway, so that's... I guess that's the history very briefly then.
Oh, okay.
I'm going blank unless you have more
questions. Yeah, no, I think that's that gives people a brief overview of what happened to Bishop Tuck.
Oh, he did die in that seminary, by the way.
Oh, yeah, okay. So
I didn't say about that part of the story if you're interested.
Yeah, what he somehow, someone said he was down in Missouri somewhere, or what happened there?
I had to take a few twists and turns in my life, but I ended up studying at the priesthood in Florida with a priest, and I still felt very badly that Archbishop Tuck had been treated the way he was. An archbishop should not be treated that way. No one should be, but not a prince of the church. So I called the FBI, and they ended up telling me that he was in Carthage, Missouri, with a Vietnamese settlement, if you will, a lot of the Vietnamese who left Vietnam in 1975 had ended up in Carthage, Missouri, where they had a Catholic community and a Catholic seminary, and they put Archbishop Tuck there, where he was probably somewhat comfortable.
Well, when you say they put them there, who's they?
Pialagi and
company. Pialagi? Okay, yeah. So basically this rich Vietnamese businessman, obviously he was hooked up with Pialagi, and together they... shipped him off to Missouri.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess they must have pacified the archbishop or made him promises. They didn't make him promises, actually. They promised him that it'd be in a nice warm climate, and they lied to him. That was not a nice warm climate. But anyway, they made some promises to him and somehow talked him into him to going out there and staying with him.
And maybe what? He just thought it was just a place to have a room and somewhere to eat? I mean, he obviously wasn't going to obviously join the Vietnamese Novus Ordo community down there.
No, he was. Well, he lived in the seminary, but they let him say the old mass. He said the mass every day, the old mass. I was told that by the superiors there. And he said the old mass to the end. They had continued to ask him to sign documents recanting what he had done. He never signed them. After he was murdered, I called the seminary, accused them of kidnapping and murder, and they said, "Oh no! He recanted everything. He didn't want anything to do with you people." They called us separatists. We were the separatists. They called us, and so they sent me these papers, letters, supposedly written by Archbishop Tuck to Rome and everything, recanting his position, renouncing saying how sorry he was that he consecrated bishops and everything, but none of them were signed. Not even a forgery. Nothing is true at all. Anyway, it was amazing to me that he went to this, let me get the time frame right. He went there probably about August or so, maybe July or August of 1984, he had gone out there. I got this information I shared with you just now about September, October of that year. He died the following December, that same December, December 84. And he shouldn't have died, because I inquired about what the cause was, and they said, well, the cause was diabetes. But the point is, he didn't have diabetes that severely. He wasn't even on insulin. He was only taking oral pills for diabetes. And it certainly shouldn't have been a terminal thing. And they waited. He didn't die until, I think it was the day after, the new Novus Ordo bishop was installed in that diocese at Springfield. And then he died in the St. John's Hospital there. They wouldn't give me too much information because I wasn't a relative. Hmm. But it just seemed the timing and the reason they gave for the death led me to believe that that really was foul play. In fact, I'll share a little story with you. At one point in this process of trying to get the Archbishop out of this country and back to France, I contacted the immigration department and told them that we have a French citizen here that's here illegally because his visa's run out, and you ought to send him back to home, you know. And it's been, what, a year and a half or so. He only had a six-month visa, as I understand it. And they said, oh, we'll take care of this. Who is it? You know, and I gave them the name and everything. And they said, okay, we'll get back to you and let you know what we're going to do. And they never called me back. So I called them back. And you know what? They denied ever having talked to me. They denied that they had any record of him ever entering the country. Now, if you ever went overseas, when you come back to America, you have to sign a card stating your country and your purpose of why you're here and how long you're going to be here. And that card goes to the Department of Immigration, and they keep a computer record of you and make sure that you go back when you're supposed to and everything. At least they did that before all the people from Mexico came here. But that's the way it was then in 1983, 84. Well, they had no record at all that he ever entered this country. This is after they sent him a passport, mind you, okay?
Wow.
So somebody up pretty high up had gotten to somebody else, and this sort of cramped the whole thing down.
And so what was actually Bishop Vasselis's reaction once he heard maybe, I don't know if anyone informed him, he was down in Missouri.
I have no idea. I didn't have any contact.
Basically, I guess what, after that one time when he seemed to fall into the Novus Ordo Church's hands when you were there, I guess he basically just felt maybe it was better at that point in time and just left it at that?
Oh, yeah, he didn't care. He didn't interest at all.
He didn't, after that point, he didn't even try to investigate it any further.
No, why would he? As far as I know, he never did. I don't know. I never had any more contact with him after that. I left the community shortly after that.
Hmm. Wow.
When he wasn't there.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, it's all very, very interesting. Well, thanks for coming on, Father Webster, and sharing with us all those details about Bishop Tuck.
Okay, I enjoyed it very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye now.